Welcome back to the Environmental Law Monitor, brought to you by Bracewell LLP. My name's Daniel Pope, and I'll be your host, and I'm particularly excited about today's episode. As I mentioned a few episodes ago, we've got a lot of ambitions for our podcast, and one of the things we want to do, and one of the things that's most exciting for us with this podcast, is that it'll be a great place to have conversations with agency officials and government representatives about substantive areas of environmental and natural resource law and policy. And so today we're taking our first step down that path. We are joined today by Mr. Craig Haas. Mr. Haas is a senior environmental scientist, and he is currently the national manager for EPA's Chemical Accident Prevention Regulatory Enforcement Program. He's joining us out of Washington, D.C. today. Welcome, Mr. Haas.
Thank you very much.
We're excited to have you here, and we are also joined today by Kevin Collins, a partner in our Bracewell Austin office. Kevin's got a lot of skill sets, and he also has the experience of being a former assistant United States attorney. Welcome, Kevin.
Thanks, Daniel. And Craig, good to see you.
You too.
So what we'll be talking about today, and what we're excited to have Mr. Haas join us for, is a conversation about the Environmental Protection Agency's risk management plan regulations. And I think this is risky with both Craig and Kevin on. They are both very deep in the world of EPA's risk management plan, but I am going to be brazen and try to describe it. If you're not familiar with RMP, here are some basic things that will help you understand what we're going to be talking about today. EPA's risk management plan regulations are promulgated under its Clean Air Act authority under Section 112R. If you in your facility store or use a threshold amount of regulated substances, you have to comply with a few different requirements. Broadly speaking, you need to evaluate the potential consequences of a chemical accident. You need to take steps to prevent those kinds of accidents, and you need to create and implement emergency response procedures. So that's my nutshell summary of the risk management plan. How did I do?
It's a great 101.
Okay, excellent. Well, I'm not going to be able to take us into 201, but I think our conversation will get us there. And, you know, we plan to host this podcast, to record this podcast, a little while ago. And in between those initial communications with Craig and today when we're recording, EPA has formally solicited comments on revisions to its current RMP regulations. Now, we took Mr. Haas and we shined bright lights in his face. We played him hours of late 90s pop rock, but he has refused to give up all of the secrets that EPA is thinking about. So we aren't going to be talking about the new rulemaking effort. That's something that you can pay attention to and comment on, but we're not going to be talking about those specifics today. Kevin and I will be tracking those developments, so please feel free to reach out to us. But thank you guys both for being with us here today. I'd love to talk to you a little bit about, Kevin, about your experience in this area as well. What have you done in the RMP world?
Well, I think it really comes down to a couple of things. I mean, I probably got my start just out of pure dumb luck, you know, being involved in a post-industrial accident at Texas City many years ago, and spent about 2 years of my life going to refineries and looking at what they do to prevent bad things from happening and get a sense of the culture of the place and what sort of culture evolves when you acquire another company and their culture. So that's sort of how I got my start. But along the way, I got to meet Craig a couple of times at different facilities where he comes out and watches his teams do the inspection element to the risk management plan program. And that's really where I began to learn that, you know, how a company complies with these regulations and how they interpret the gray area in those regulations is really an important fundamental aspect of, you know, keeping the world safe. So it's both on the front end of, you know, being compliant, helping companies understand the regs and how to implement them, interpret them. And then on the backside, if you have the unfortunate incident to have occurred, is helping companies respond to inquiries from EPA and other agencies. And, you know, that's something we'll talk about today, I hope, with Craig, is things that he's seen that is useful and things that he's seen that's sort of obstructive and not useful. And it'd be nice to get his opinions about that.
Absolutely. Well, let's start off there. Craig, you've had extensive experience with RMP. Can you tell us a little bit about how long you have been with EPA and how long in particular you've been working with EPA's risk management plan?
Sure. Yeah, I started with EPA in 1990, so I've been here for a while now. Bounced around for a relatively long time. I started out doing wood heaters. I worked on coal-fired power plant enforcement, refinery enforcement, all from the regular stationary source end of the Clean Air Act, for those of you familiar with that. Also was a manager in the RCRA program, which is our hazardous waste program. About 15 years ago, I started getting my feet wet into 112R. And that slice of my portfolio expanded over time to now it's essentially my 100, all of my time at EPA is now devoted to the risk management program.
Excellent. Terrific. Kevin, do you want to follow up on that?
Well, sure. I think, you know, one thing and by the way, Craig, congratulations. I think, is this your 32nd year with the agency or 31st year?
I just started. Yeah. My 31st anniversary is, I think, next week or something like that. Yeah.
Amazing. So, you know, I think it's always interesting to talk to people that have been doing anything for that long. I think most people today don't stick with the same employer for so long. And, you know, you described a couple of different things you're able to do. But in the context of the RMP program, you know, from your perspective over the last 15 years, what are some key evolutionary changes that you've observed as you've, you know, sort of watched companies try to comply with the regs as they've been written?
Well, I think there's more maturity in the program, both from the regulated entity side, but also I would say from EPA side. The regs were promulgated in the late 90s, became effective, I think, in 1999. So both EPA and the regulated community had a learning curve. What does this thing mean? Those of you familiar with other parts of EPA and also RMP may appreciate the fact that this is a performance-based standard. It's not an emission standard. We're not looking at numbers coming out of a smokestack or numbers coming out of a water discharge point. We're looking at safety cultures and how our facilities managing overall risks. And because it's a performance-based standard, I think there was a learning curve on what that's going to mean for us as a regulator, and then also from the regulated entities, how are we going to comply with this thing where EPA is not telling you must install this X device. It's saying you must create an overall accident prevention program that is going to make the likelihood of accidents smaller. So it's, I would say the evolution is that we're more sophisticated, the industry is more sophisticated in understanding what their obligations are.
You know, is there anything in particular that companies have been able to demonstrate here recently, say within the last 3 or 4 years, that sort of give you an indication that their culture around safety and in their implementation of the program is achieving a higher level?
That is really difficult to generalize. And I think I'll put RMP in perspective. We've got about close to 12,000 facilities are regulated by RMP nationally. And that ranges, the swath of industries that we touch ranges from everything from a small ice cream refrigeration facility to the largest refineries in the United States. So it is very difficult to say, going into a refrigerated warehouse, you know, what sorts of things are we seeing there compared to what are we seeing at the big guys down in Texas. Having said, I can't answer the question, I'm now going to attempt to answer the question, however, and say that I think it's very telling if a facility has people dedicated only to compliance issues. Now, very large multinational corporations, that's quite common, but in smaller sized industries, and smaller facilities, that's less common, but it's I hate to use the word comforting, but I'll use it anyway. It's comforting to see, even at the small facilities, if there is one individual who is tasked with the responsibility of ensuring that safety program, rather than it being diffuse. And I think that leads to a lot of a lot of potential pitfalls, a lot of potential gaps in an accident prevention program if there's not an individual who is responsible and whose head essentially may be on the chopping block if things go bad.
Sort of a, you know, the buck stops here with somebody, at least with respect to safety.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
You know, it's interesting to hear you discuss that and also describe the broad range of facilities that may be subject to the program. It makes me also think about, you know, industry's statutory responsibility under the general duty clause under the Clean Air Act. And maybe you can take a moment to sort of help companies of all sizes understand that, because even on the sophisticated large end of the spectrum, you know, I've encountered companies that don't really appreciate the fact that even though they're not subject to the RMP, they're still subject to the general duty clause. So maybe you could describe for our audience just exactly what those three duties are under the general duty clause.
Well, let's, before we talk about the general duty clause, I want to back out and make sure that we discuss what that general duty clause is starting off with. And Kevin, I know that you've paid a lot of attention to this. When I was talking about RMP at the outset of the podcast, I talked about things like threshold amounts of chemicals and that sort of thing. So how is the general duty clause different from what we talk about when we're talking about, you know, normal RMP stuff?
Well, as I mentioned, the RMP regulations are codified at 40 CFR Part 68, so find it there. That implements the statutory requirements at Clean Air Act 112R Section 7. Clean Air Act 112R Section 1 is the general duty clause. Now, they both are accident prevention requirements under the Clean Air Act, but the regulations at Part 68 only apply to those facilities that have a listed chemical above a threshold quantity. For example, ammonia, anhydrous ammonia above 10,000 pounds, that makes you subject to the Part 68 RMP regulations. For those facilities that are below threshold or that have other extremely hazardous substances that are not listed, you are still subject to the general duty clause requirements at Section 112R1. And there are three duties enumerated at 112R1. First, you have to identify the hazards associated with your chemicals and your processes. The second one is you have to design and maintain a safe facility. And the third is you have to minimize the consequences of any accidental releases that may occur. So even if you don't have a threshold quantity of those regulated substances, that doesn't mean that you have no duty whatsoever to operate safely. You do. And you'll find that duty at Clean Air Act 112R1.
Got it. So if I have 8,000 pounds of ammonia, I need to be looking at the general duty clause, even if there's nothing else at my facility that says I'm strictly in the world of 40 CFR Part 68.
Exactly. Right.
And I think one thing that concerns companies on the more sophisticated end of the spectrum, that doesn't mean necessarily our largest companies, just more sophisticated companies, is I think they start to worry that if they try to satisfy their general duty clause requirements by grabbing pieces of the RMP and using the RMP tools to do that, that somehow they're accepting that the RMP covers them. And I'm just, you know, I don't think that's right, but Craig, maybe you have an opinion about that.
Well, I would say that pretending that RMP applies may be a good way to also comply with GDC. In legal fact, RMP does not apply, but if you're acting as if it does, I think that may be, in many cases, a good way to actually comply with the general duty clause requirements.
Yeah, I agree. You know, especially with respect to hazard assessment, which is the first sort of general duty that you have. You know, the RMP program has a number of tools and a number of different hazard identification methodologies that you could pull out and use. I guess the question, you know, when the EPA inspectors get around to these smaller organizations or facilities that are not subject to the RMP and they're doing a general duty clause inspection, what's the best way for these smaller organizations to demonstrate compliance with those three statutory duties? What are some things that stand out in the past for you that say, oh yeah, they're doing a good job?
Well, I think we would focus more on the first two prongs of general duty. One is to do a hazard review. If a facility has taken a serious look at the hazards posed by their operation, I think that would make us more comfortable than a facility that really doesn't understand what they're doing. And it's sadly common for us to find that sort of lack of sophistication at smaller facilities. These can be very small, very limited resources, not a lot of understanding of the underlying obligations that they have, and they simply don't know what they're dealing with. So if we're looking at a general duty clause facility and we see an actual hazard review performed perhaps by a qualified engineer, that would be great. The second thing is the design and maintain a safe facility obligation. I think we all appreciate that there are a lot of industry codes and standards that have been developed over the years by industry itself to say, amongst people who are like us, we think this is what we need to do in order to prevent bad things from happening. So if a facility understands the existence of those codes and standards and is working to comply with them, that would also give us comfort.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation about using your industry codes and standards as a way to demonstrate compliance. It makes me think about problems I see with some of the sophisticated companies where, you know, they look at an industry standard and then they compare that standard to what they're doing with inside their facility. And sometimes they do it differently. And there's a lot of concern over, well, if, you know, organization ABC has a standard that's different from the industry standard, can they still demonstrate compliance with not only the general duty clause, but also if they're subject to RMP, you know, their obligations under the RMP plan program?
Oh, yeah, the short answer is sure, absolutely. We're not in the business of telling facilities how to operate or, you know, what they need to do in order to operate safely. However, if they're not using a recognized industry code and standard, they essentially need to convince us why that's still protective. If they're deviating in some respect, I mean, these codes and standards go through a huge amount of analysis, review, approval processes. It takes a long time for an industry to come out with a standard. If you look at, I'm going to use the example of American Petroleum Institute standards. Those are very well-developed and signed off on documents. And if a facility that may otherwise, we would assume, would be relying on an API standard but is not, in fact, using it, we really want to know why and what they're doing that is not in agreement with the API standard, why that is still protective.
And is that best demonstrated, you know, through, you know, written comments to the file contemporaneous, or, you know, when the team shows up to inspect and they discover it? What would you prefer to see to get comfort?
Yeah, that was my question.
That's a very complicated analysis on EPA's part. And it's nothing I think that we would do on site. So this would be an exchange of documents after an on-site inspection.
Like a request for information or something along those lines.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, let's use that comment to sort of springboard over to, you know, good old fashioned traditional RMP inspections. Maybe describe how EPA implements its national inspection program for RMP. I don't know that everybody understands the criteria the agency uses to select the facilities or the stationary sources that it chooses to inspect.
Sure. Well, it's typically done on a regional basis. There are 10 EPA regional offices around the country. They will pick the specific targets based on guidance that we issue out of headquarters. I should also mention, as by way of an aside, that we've been operating under a national compliance initiative for chemical accident risk reduction for the last, 4+ years now, specific to 112R. And part of that national compliance initiative created standards by which we would like facilities to select their targets. We also have what's called a high risk list of facilities out of the RMP program, and you get on the high risk list by one of three ways. You either have had a serious accident in the last 5 years, or you have more than 100,000 people in your what we call our worst case scenario zone, or you have a large quantity of chemical on site. Any of those three will get you on the high risk list. So we ask regions to focus on high risk facilities and facilities that are in within the National Compliance Initiative focus areas. But other than that, the 10 regional offices are given wide latitude.
So let's talk a little bit about, you know, when the inspection team shows up, you know, things from your perspective as essentially the national program manager for this, you know, what are some good things that stationary sources can do that help your teams get their work done? And then of course, we'll come back and talk about some of the things that aren't so good.
Yeah. Having files in order is very helpful to us from a regulatory perspective. Because this is a very document heavy kind of analysis we need to do. Again, we're not looking at emissions monitoring or continuous emission monitoring data. We're looking at how often have you done inspections? How often have you trained your employees? You know, that very document heavy. So having a document filing system that's easily utilized is great. Having people available to us to talk to, because again, because this is, in some respects, this is us getting a feel for the safety culture. If we have access to employees, easy access to employees that we can talk to, that's also makes our job easier and could potentially minimize our time on site, which is really everybody's goal. Nobody wants EPA hanging out at their facility for a long time.
Well, it seems like for smaller facilities, having some kind of filing system, maybe even a binder on the shelf somewhere, could be essential, especially when an employee may be wearing a number of hats. They may be responsible for safety, but they may have some other kind of role at some of these smaller sites as well. So that's very useful.
You know, something you said about just in the examples of things the team looks at that can be helpful made me think of an idea. You know, you said a couple of times today, you know, we're trying to assess the culture of the stationary source and whether they're meeting their obligations under the program. And you mentioned training. You know, what's your reaction to a stationary source that onboards new employees, goes ahead and gives them a test to sort of establish their baseline knowledge, and then moves them through whatever training program they have for those operators or those individuals? And then assigns, you know, administers the same test 3 months later, 6 months later, whatever it is, and measures the gap in performance improvement, whether it's up or down. You know, have you seen companies do that? And if you have you had a good reaction to it? And if you haven't, would you have a good reaction to it? I'm just trying to find some tangible examples of things that listeners can walk away with and maybe implement.
Well, a continuing learning process would be a great thing for a company to have for any of their employees to make sure that they're not only initially qualified, but also their skills are improving over time. I think that would be a wonderful thing for us to see how they do that. You know, if they give a test one day and then, as you mentioned, a few months later, test again to see an improvement, that would be one way of doing that as well. But, and you know, encouraging and emphasizing continuing education would be great.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we wanted to, you know, you mentioned some things you like to see when the team shows up. What are some things you've encountered that you just wish people wouldn't do that? You know, here's an opportunity to explain to the regulated industry, you know, some things they might consider not doing when your teams show up.
Well, you know, I'll go back to the point that nobody wants to have EPA on site longer than needed. We don't want to be on site longer than needed either. But there are times when we will request documents and then there will be some sort of internal review process that a facility maintains that document needs to go through before it's turned over to us. If we think the delay becomes unreasonable, we'll start pushing on that. I mean, a stationary source has an obligation to determine or to demonstrate compliance essentially instantly. You need to be in continuous compliance with Clean Air Act requirements. And if you're making us wait a day and a half to see a document, that makes us very suspicious. It frustrates everybody. So I would say that would be one of the big things that one of our big hurdles.
Yeah. You know, I think about that. I think about in the wake, particularly in the wake of incidents where everybody's concerned about litigation risk, you know, a lot of times legal teams will stand in between the agency and the facility, and can, you know, slow things down. And I've given a lot of thought of that to that over the last decade, I guess, or more. And my thought is, you know, when it comes to certain kinds of documents, like for example, a process hazard analysis, you know, those documents are definitely business confidential and sensitive, but there isn't any attorney client privilege information inside the PHA risk table, you know? And so what I've encouraged people to do when they have a team show up is just put the inspectors in a room with the hard copy of the PHA or get the somebody to drive the software so that they can review it. And then you guys are looking at the PHA almost instantaneously, or you're looking at your cyclical audit, you know, pretty quickly so that you can, your team can get a grasp on what's going on. What's your reaction to that advice? Of course, that's heresy among lawyers, but you know,
that's, well, our EPA's position is that you need to demonstrate compliance continuously. And if that means we need to see your PHA now, that means we want to see your PHA now. I understand the concern. If we want to take documents away with us, sure, review them, bait stamp them, log them in whatever system you have. But if we need to know whether or not you have a PHA, we don't want to wait for a review before we have access to that PHA.
Well, good. I feel better when I put clients in a headlock and try to convince them that this is okay. And it also sounds like, and it's been my experience, by the way, with your teams, that, you know, we'll have time to bait stamp things and log them and assert our confidentiality claims, you know, after the review. But we don't have to do that before. And maybe that's the big takeaway for the audience is, like Craig said, you want to minimize the presence of visitors on your site. You're trying to get back to normal operations, potentially, you know, let them look at the docs. And then if they want to take them, we'll make copies.
Well, I think that's great. One thing, Craig, as we wind down here that I thought would be interesting, you know, we are in the third quarter of 2021 and we're still dealing with fluctuating work environments. A couple of us on this podcast are recording from places that aren't our office as we deal with the COVID-19 pandemic. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on how industries have successfully navigated these kind of changing work environments, rotating personnel on site and those sorts of things, and still successfully complied with the general duty clause and their RMP requirements. Have there been any good takeaways from what you've seen over the past 18 months?
You know, that's hard to say because I think our engagement with industry has sort of also tailed off a bit. You know, we're not out doing physical inspections, or we haven't been until recently. So, I mean, I would congratulate most of the facilities in the nation for adapting and adopting and doing what they have to do, despite travel restrictions and the difficulty of maintaining a presence of employees on site. You know, we're all dealing with a novel situation, and I think, you know, the vast majority of people, as I said, are really doing a great job, doing the best they can. But to say, you know, what they're doing, I'm not quite sure.
You know, I have a thought on that, Daniel, and I'd like to get Craig's thoughts on this. You know, I personally, Zoom has worn me out. I mean, it really has. But I also see advantages to it. I mean, honestly, because it does, you know, for the regulated industry, it can cut down on some costs if they do things via Zoom. We're all comfortable doing it via Zoom. You can see each other. You can't do everything you want to do. So I guess my question, Craig, is, you know, going forward, maybe, you know, would the agency start to develop a hybrid sort of inspection model or tool where, you know, they can do some things over a Zoom call in advance of a visit to minimize the days on site? Would they consider using, you know, document rooms, electronic document rooms, so they have quick access to documents and maybe have a Zoom call with that to pull a document up and have a discussion with the facilities experts before they get to the site to try to get some of their questions answered? Could you see that being in the EPA's toolbox going forward?
Yeah, I definitely do. You know, just because we haven't been able to travel since COVID began doesn't mean we haven't been monitoring compliance. We have been doing those sorts of things. It's become much more document intensive with a lot more information request letters going out. And then in many instances, we've been doing multi-day compliance evaluations, even at facilities like refineries, completely remotely. I think everybody understands, though, that that's not ideal, because this, in an accident prevention program, you don't want to have somebody slap a coat of paint on it and then take a camera around and show the EPA team, oh, look how pretty this all is when it's rusting on the other side. You know, everybody understands it. This sort of remote engagement will never take the place of an on-site evaluation, but I think there definitely is an opportunity for us to do more upfront work, giving facilities perhaps a greater lead time as to when we are actually physically going to be on site, requesting a more specific set of documents so that whatever review process needs to occur does occur before we even get there, to maybe minimize the time we're there.
You know, Daniel Craig's comment reminded me of being on an inspection with him once where we were looking to the right at this vessel and, you know, everybody was pleased, but using tremendous peripheral vision, Craig Haas looked left and saw a rusted vessel that he did not like. And that's the vessel that, you know, we saw later in the inspection report. So let's talk a little bit, I think in the few minutes we have left, about, and we're not talking about the proposed comments or anything like that, but just, you know, the current status of the rule, you know, had some retained requirements that sort of survived the effort to get rid of the RMP and the, you know, all the court cases and everything. And they really center around local emergency coordination. And I'm just, you know, some of those requirement deadlines are now upon us. And I'm just curious if that's made its way into the checklist. You know, there's the level 3 audit checklist, there's other checklists, you know, how are the EPA teams dealing with making sure that companies are doing what they're supposed to do with respect to the modified rules around emergency response?
Yeah, those new requirements have made their way into the checklists. We're also working on some guidance documents that are in the review process now to release. So I would encourage everybody to www.epa.gov/RMP is where you're going to find a lot of that stuff. Because as you say, it has been a moving target over the last 4 or 5 years. We had the modernization rule, then the reconsideration rule, and now potential new rulemaking. So the ground is shifting somewhat. I think the heart of the regulation, though, has not really changed. It's remained the same. So the changes have been on the margins, not really at the core.
All right. I think that's a good place to close, unless you have any other questions, Kevin.
Nope, that's a good place to close. You know, I just want to let the regulated community know that Craig and his staff that I've interacted with have always been, you know, they've always welcomed an honest question. You know, if you have an honest question about something, you should call them and ask them, or get your attorney to call them and ask them. They're very good, because I think they just want facilities to operate as safely as possible. And if you have something that's unique about your facility or some obstacle that's preventing you from accomplishing one of the requirements under the program, you just have to help them understand what it is and demonstrate how you're mitigating something in the short run that ultimately you're going to correct. And Craig, if I've gone too far about, you know, the grace you'll give people, you know, check me right here and tell me I'm wrong.
No, I would say we're never lenient, but we're always reasonable.
I think that was written on the paddle of my 8th grade biology teacher.
Never lenient, always reasonable.
And please do get in touch with us if you have questions about this.
Absolutely. And thank you, Craig. Kevin and I will be monitoring the status of the rulemaking. So if any clients want to reach out to us about that and pepper us with questions, we'd welcome that. But thank you so much for spending time with us today. And thank you for all of your work and leadership at EPA. That's something that we value as well. And thank you all for listening to us. Be sure to rate us, subscribe if you like what you heard. We are going to continue bringing excellent conversations your way that help you wrap your head around the developments that we're seeing in environmental law and natural resources law and policy. And if you have suggestions, comments, or maybe some constructive criticism, please feel free to reach out to me at daniel.pope@bracewell.com. We'll see you soon.